Tape 2, Side 1, National Council of Jewish Women, Oral History. We are interviewing Betty Simon in her home.
Betty Ann, there were a few things that I didn't get the last time we were together. Would you tell me something about your grandmother Cohn's name and something more about her, please?
My grandmother Cohn, I never knew, because she died when she was 42 years old. Her name was Anna Elizabeth Biggs Cohen. And she was born in Canarsie, New York. As near as I can figure out from the things that my mother and my Aunt Betty have told me, she gathered all her courage together to run away with my grandfather because her father was violently opposed to her being involved with a Jew. But they ran away and they got married and lived in Philadelphia. And my grandfather worked for Dalsimer Shoe Store in Philadelphia. And they had, my mother and my aunt were born in Philadelphia. And then my grandfather was offered the job at Kaufman's department store, moved into Pittsburgh. My grandmother must have had a rough time. She had all kinds of friends in Philadelphia, and then she's uprooted and comes to Pittsburgh, where she knew not a soul. And My family's always sort of thinking that she may have died at the early age that she did from a dieting problem. She was obviously very anxious for her children to have some sort of religious upbringing. She sent them to whatever church was nearest. And but they always knew they were Jews. And their name was Cohen. And that was important to them. And that's about all I can tell you.
About your grandmother Goodman.
My grandmother Goodman was a tough cookie. She had to be. She had 12 children, 10 of whom lived to be at her 50th wedding anniversary. Which is pretty good. Her name was Rebecca, and she married my grandfather. There was always said that maybe the Davis family, Barnetta Davis, was responsible for their getting together, and that she wore Mrs. Davis's wedding dress when she got married. That's never been real clear, but that was the implication. And she lived in Connellsville, and she had all these children, and then they moved to Pittsburgh for a short time when my grandfather had at that point, the hotel, and when Prohibition came in and he couldn't sell liquor anymore, I think he retired, and they moved to Pittsburgh, and they moved in complete retirement to Atlantic City. So that's my father's mother, and she lived to be in her mid-80s.
Your husband's father,
Mahon,
you need something about him.
Well, Dad Simon was the son of an extremely well-to-do family. I think I told you that his father had gone to Swarthmore and to the University of Pennsylvania Law School, and he was a practicing lawyer, and he owned real estate. And my father-in-law was the spoiled baby in this family. And his brother went to law school, He never, I don't know whether he graduated from high school. I think he maybe barely got out of high school. He was a real playboy. And he, and my mother-in-law, who also came from a very well-to-do family, got married at a young, and they lived a really wild sort of life. And then the crash came, and my father-in-law really had to go to work because his father decided to retire. He didn't want to be aggravated anymore with having business, and he had plenty of money, so he retired. Now, Dad's mother also had season tickets to the Philadelphia Symphony, and then used to take my husband when he was a small child, and she loved music, but my father-in-law never picked up on that somehow, but he went to work, and he used to tell the story about how he really read the ads in the paper. He almost became a butcher at one point. They had a really rough time. They had belonged to country clubs and all kinds of stuff, and they had to drop out of that. And I think my mother-in-law never quite got over being a little bitter because of having to change her lifestyle. I mean, she used to say how terrible it was, and they never knew from one day to the next where the next nickel was coming from. And then in the course of conversation, I found out she had a maid the whole time. So you know that it was not as bad as it is. It would seem to be, but the come down had to be very difficult. But Dad worked very hard. He was he turned out to be a very hard worker, and he built up an insurance agency, which my brother-in-law has expanded enormously at this point. But he did a very nice job, and worked hard.
Thank you. Interesting to know about, great to know about, but you know quite a bit really about your roots. I couldn't give as much information. You talked about your aunt in Dayton.
Yes, my dear aunt.
And an uncle in California. Just touched on them. Maybe you can tell us a little bit more about them.
My mother was one of three children. She was the eldest, and her 5 years younger is her sister Elizabeth, who married Henry Rothenberg, who was the president of the temple at the time, in the Temple Emmanuel in Dayton, Ohio. And I always have to laugh because we all grew up, you know, in this house that was a mixture of all kinds. I always had a Christmas tree. And Aunt Betty always had a Christmas tree, and it was her natural inclination to have a Christmas tree, and when the rabbi came to see her and there was a Christmas tree, she was in big trouble in Dayton, Ohio. So they went on to become she used to go to services all the time and became a devout member of the congregation, Reformed congregation in Dayton, but we always had a giggle over that. She's so very blonde that everybody thought my uncle had married a Shiksa, but he hadn't. She always felt she was, and still does, she's very Jewish. Her brother, my uncle Eugene, was named after Eugene Dalsimer, who gave my grandfather the job in Philadelphia. Is retired and lives with his wife Lois Green, who was originally from Pittsburgh. They live now in Paradise, California. My Aunt Lois is the artist in the family. She did the scenery,
yes,
and all that on Around the World in 80 Days. She's quite a woman, talented woman. And one of her children lives in New Jersey. My cousin Greg, he's younger than my own children. And he is a musician. He, not only does he play the bass, but he also has a repair set up where he repairs bows.
Oh,
so that he is so knowledgeable about ivory and everything that has to do with fine wood and antiques and everything. To meet this young man and get to know him when he was in his 30s, that he knew so much about antique things, I just fell in love with him immediately. He's a doll. And he has a son he named Benjamin Cohen, which is after my grandfather, which just made us all quail. Gene was in the shoe business with my grandfather in California after my grandfather left Pittsburgh for many years, both on their own, and then Gene was with Saks.
Go back and see my little notes, little places that I had little, we're getting more up to date in my questions, so maybe we're moving into your activities, because you mentioned somebody that you seem, everybody should know, but I don't, not being in Pittsburgh, Marion something Cohen, who suggested the call for action.
Marion Wise, W-E-I-S. Mrs. Eugene. She went to Wellesley.
So you did.
She sort of was 2 years ahead of me. She sort of, you know, felt a little responsible for me.
Okay. Great. Do you want to pick up then the things that you had questions?
Yes, there are several things I wanted to question you about. We discussed the shelters. What was the original concept for the Whale's Tail?
Whale's Tail was in existence long before I got involved, and the original idea for Whale's Tail was a coffee house back in the 60s. And this was, as I say, long before I had anything to do with it. And that evolved into the people who, it was the church groups, I think it was the Lutherans and the Catholics, were concerned about the kids, the runaways at that time, on the street in those days. That was, if you remember, with the hippies and the whole thing. So they had, that's how Whale's Tail got started, and then it evolved into a very normal agency that had two parts to the program back then. One was the shelter, amicus house for runaway kids with dependent kids. And the other was our drug and alcohol outpatient center called Karma House, that's on Fifth Avenue in Oakland. And that's where it's grown enormously from there. Until now, Whale's Tail has the contract with Allegheny County for sheltering, evaluating, and temporarily sheltering the teenage, adolescent, dependent, not delinquent, dependent teenagers in Allegheny County. And right now we're having a major problem because the county funds have been cut back and there's a shortage of beds, and the kids who come to us for evaluation, and then we would supposedly move them out into a foster home or into another facility where they can have longer term care, or back home, whatever, depending on the situation. There is such a shortage of beds that these kids we're stuck with these kids for a lot longer, and that's not good for the kids, and it's not good for the program. And right now we're working very hard to try and get the county and the state to realize what they're doing. You know, sometimes the money people take over and they don't care about kids because kids don't vote.
How are the shelters for children manned?
Oh, the shelter that these shelters are professionally manned 24 hours a day around the clock. They have staff there, both male and female, because we have both kinds of kids.
How do you differentiate between dependent and delinquent?
Well, delinquent, there's been
a crime. And those you don't, those go to the
those go courts. Some another, no, we go to, our kids go to courts too, but the, that's a different system.
I see. Okay.
That's a different system. Requiring different, you know, regulations and stuff. So our kids are abused, neglected, that sort of thing.
Is there anything done as far as the parents of these children are concerned?
Well, if a kid shows up, we insist that the parent be notified within a short period of time. Most of the situations today are kids who have been thrown out or who have run away because of a problem with a parent. And that's what I mean by evaluate. You have to evaluate and see what is the situation, because you certainly don't want to send a child back into a dangerous situation. On the other hand, if it's just a big blowout over a bad report card, then a little we would recommend a little counseling or something like that. And sometimes they just stay in shelter for a couple days, and the parents come in, and we have a outpatient clinic type setup, and they you know, they spend time in counseling, and maybe it's over a period of months. But the kid goes home, and the goal is to get the kids back home. Obviously, we don't, unless it's a dangerous situation.
Are they monitored?
Oh yes. You mean after they go home?
Yeah.
Yes. If they're in counseling, they have to come in on a regular basis. The follow-up is not as I would wish. Again, money. I think we only follow them for a year.
You had mentioned an association with ORT.
Right.
What did you do with ORT?
Well, it was a really wonderful time in my life. When I got married, this was a new organization. And I'll be very honest with you about this. My first inclination, of course, was to be involved with council, because I'd been involved with council as a teenager. But it looked to a bunch of us who were... We were 22 years old. The council was being run by a bunch of old people. And, of course, I think the old people are younger than I am now. But it was, you know, how you perceive things differently when you're young. And here was this new organization that was offering us this opportunity to be big shots at an early age. This is my perception. I could be all wrong, but this is when I look back on it, how I saw. And you know, pioneering in a new organization, and it was very appealing to a lot of us, because at that time we were college, right out of college, and this was had a heavy emphasis on education, or you know, training programs and education, and we thought that was, of course, the way to solve the world's problem. And I was extremely active. And my mother-in-law in Philadelphia was extremely active in the Council of Jewish Federation, nothing to do with Israel. Whatever that group was in Philadelphia had absolutely nothing to do with Israel. She was very active in that, and they had a little gift shop set up in Philly. It was all personal order. Actually, didn't have a shop. It was done by phone. And she was the artist. And she would paint waste baskets and Kleenex boxes and hampers and leather goods and whatever. They were personalized with monograms and names, and there were trays and things like that. And I thought that was terrific. I mentioned this at an ORT meeting, and several of the people there said, oh, that's a wonderful idea. Why don't we do that in Pittsburgh? And we did get space on the top floor of, is it Hillel? It was on the corner of, was the street past Shady Avenue. the next street over going away from Squirrel Hill.
Denison.
And on the third floor, we had a...
That was Pioneer Women.
Mm-hmm. No, this was Ort. And we had this...
No, the building.
Workshop. Oh, no, it wasn't a building. It might have become that.
It became that building.
I think it was Hillel at the time. Or Hebrew Institute. That's what it was. Hebrew Institute. And we climbed up there. And what we'd do is that the different Ort chapter meetings, we would take those of us who were involved, and there I was never artistic, so I was the business end of it. And besides, I had my degree in business, supposedly, retailing. So we'd take around this carton full of examples, and people would order. And of course, it became a popular baby gift to give them a monogram, a personalized wastebasket. I do it to this day. You know, people do love it, even though the Ort gift shop doesn't exist anymore. But we did.
Sadly missed.
Yes. Thank you. We went into.
Off the record, if you ever find any more of those plastic lingerie bags.
Yeah, I'd like to have one too. I'd love to have it. I'm hoping the temple would do that, but then.
No, I've asked there and suggested.
Well, we did. We started this up. I had one child, and I had a miscarriage lugging that stuff around. I mean, I probably would have had a miscarriage anyhow, but I remember carrying that carton up to the third floor full of stuff, having been to a bunch of more chapter meetings. And then we expanded, and we took the space that we subsequently had on Northumberland. And we developed that into a much bigger business. First, we went from a little hole in the wall to then we expanded around the corner to that whole place. It's now abandoned rug. And what the hard thing was, I mean, if I could have imported my mother-in-law to Pittsburgh, which would have killed me on one hand, but she was such a wonderful artist, and she just did these things just beautifully. That was always our problem, getting enough people to do the artwork. And the name on. I used to take stuff by the carload over to Margie Mark's house and to Arlene Miller's house when she lived in Pittsburgh. And then we had artists, but you had to wait on them. I mean, the ones that would come in and actually do the stuff in the store were rare. We kept a file. We were the first people to keep a file because the stuff was personalized. You certainly couldn't send duplicates. So we had to keep a confirmation file and then we expanded into Christmas presents for businesses. I spent one Christmas at the post office in Squirrel Hill because we sent 100-some cheese trays for one of the corporations in town all over the world. Remember Red at the post office in Squirrel Hill? He let me come back. He said, "Oh, come on back here. Work back here. It'll be easier than you trying to hand me all these things," because the postage was different depending on where it was going to go. But we had a wonderful camaraderie, and we got to the point where we went to New York to buy, and we had a wonderful time. Doing that. With the crew of women that I worked with, and gave me, I think, a lot of the confidence to go to work full time, which I did in September of 1963. I remember the year very well because it was in November that President Kennedy was killed, and it was like I went to work. I was hired, I think I told, did I tell you this, that I was hired more because of who I was than because of any, I had never sold a dress before in my life. And the first dress I sold, I had on the lady backwards. Looked nice. it turned out to be, I wasn't too happy working and selling dresses. That was not my thing. And I heard about and was interviewed and went to work for Papagallo, which was then owned by Corinne Schneider and Eleanor Goldstein Resnick now. And Eleanor was moving to Philadelphia, and they needed somebody else who had a business head. And I was, in fact, the manager and did all the books as well as selling there in this little tiny shoe store. And we had a ball because it was the most popular shoe that anybody could wear in those days. They were lousy. My grandfather used to say, "Oh, I can't believe that you're selling these terrible shoes." He was out in California.
We called them Gaffa Powers.
Yeah. But they were the in thing. And we had more fun. And through that association, it was funny, I met an awful lot of very important Pittsburghers came through those doors to buy those shoes. Really amusing. They can't figure out when they see me now where they know me from. It was, and I was there, and that store expanded and grew and then moved around the corner, and I was there for 6 years, working full time. It was not easy. I was a sort of a pioneer in my gang for working, and it wasn't easy. I think my children benefited enormously because they learned the streetcar system in Pittsburgh. I wasn't around. I think they became much more self-reliant as a result of the fact that I wasn't available to chauffeur. But there's a lot of guilt involved when you're working and nobody else you know is, and it was hard at times.
And you're doing your own thing.
Yeah. And there was a lot of people that said, "What's the matter with your husband and your father? Why are you doing this?" And of course, those same people are the same ones who said subsequently when I started doing all these other things for no pay, "Well, what do you mean you're not getting paid?" I've had it both ways. I'm in that transition. And it's the same people. It's really amusing.
You can switch that off.
Which? Are you still active with ORT?
No. Haven't been in a long time. We grew apart when I went to work. My very dear friend at that point was president of ORT, Doris Lovner. And now, pleased to report, she is the first woman president of the United Jewish Federation in Sarasota, Florida. So she's a widow now. Yeah, and we still keep in touch. But, you can't, I did her President's Day while I was working. But I couldn't, I just couldn't keep up with your standard day in, day out, or week in, week out Jewish community activities. Working 40 hours a week or more was just, it was just too much. And I'd like to throw in right here, if I could, my husband, who, without whom I could not have done any of this. He was one of the first liberated husbands. I worked on Saturdays, and he took those kids, and he took them to doctor's appointments, and he did all kinds of stuff with our children that in those days, most of the men would be out on the golf course and wouldn't be even available, even think it was their responsibility. And Dave pitched right in. And that's how we were a first working couple. He traveled a lot, too, those days. But he pitched right in. Now, whatever happened, I went on from when I had enough of working, which was some 7 years later, and I really probably should throw in here, if I haven't told you this already, that at one point while I was working, I went to my bosses, and after all, there were two women, and I said, "The men that I'm supervising make more money than I do." And they said, "Well, they have a wife and families to support," which was the age old. And I said, oh, yes, that's right. And I mean, so three women, you know, here we are, three fairly intelligent women running a very pretty successful business, and we were so into what we used to be, and we laugh about it now because obviously Women's Lib has done an enormous amount. 10 years later, they wouldn't have said that in a million years, nor, you know, that would have happened. So we really will sort of live through some of the changes. But it's hard. Retailing is hard. In those years, working full-time at a fairly responsible job, I made a little more than $6,000 a year. When I thought about going back to work, 10 years later, I had been working for 7 years, so it was 3 years after I quit working, we'll say, in that period of time, I could have had a job that would have, with the stores that would have been involved in shopping centers, so the hours would have been even worse than Shadyside, and I would have been paid top dollar then, and that would have made it around $12,000 a year. So,
end of side one, take two, continued on side two.
It wasn't hard to give it up. I gave it up and was fluffing around for something to do when I told you, I think I went to the Wellesley Club meeting and I heard about Call for Action, and that's how.